This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud. I am recording this episode at Catalyst Con West at the LA Marriott Burbank Airport Hotel. And to find out about the next Catalyst event, you can go to catalystcon.com and use the code Tristan for $10 off your registration. Let me tell you about today's guests. Cindy Lee Alves, Masters of Education, is a doctoral candidate at Widener University's Center for Sexuality Studies, where she also earned her master's in education. Her research interests include sexual orientation, gender, pleasure, and intersectionality. Currently, Cindy teaches human sexuality courses at various colleges in New York and New Jersey, as well as guest lectures and provides workshops for adults and young people. Ida Mandalay is an award-winning bilingual powerhouse trained as a social worker, sexuality educator, and nonprofit management professional. Hailing from Puerto Rico and with firm roots in LGBTQ activism, she regularly blogs about social justice issues and has presented across North America on a variety of sexuality topics and their intersections with issues such as digital literacy and anti-racism. Ida is currently pursuing her Master's of Social Work at Boston University with a focus on aging populations and holds a BA in Gender and Sexuality Studies from Brown. Her primary affiliations are with the Women of Color Sexual Health Network, where she serves on the executive committee, and the Center for Sexual Pleasure and Health, where she's worked since 2010 and now acts as a consultant. Past projects include sexual health and LGBTQ work at a domestic violence agency, crisis response with victims of assault, and leadership on a number of national and regional coalitions on HIV prevention, sexuality education, and LGBTQ anti-violence. Anaïn Bjorkqvist is a speaker, certified sex educator, sex and wellness coach, and a published erotica writer. Her life's purpose is to serve women as a companion and a guide on the journey from yearning to thriving. Anaïn's mission is to help women ditch perfection for pleasure. Her writing, her weekly podcast, Sex, Love, Joy, and live workshops teach women how to consciously let go, trust their intuition, and embody turn-on. Anaïn is dedicated to bringing fierce women together because the best learning and personal growth happens within intimate groups of women sharing their experiences. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Cindy, Ida, Anaïn.
Yay!
Okay, let's begin with the Women of Color Sexual Health Network. It's a group of women, both domestic and international, with a focus on the sexual and reproductive health needs of women of color. The mission of the group is to encourage and include more women of color in the field of sexuality, sexology, and sexual health. How was the group founded? I know you are not founders. You are not the founders. Mm-hmm. So tell us who the founders are and how it all came together.
Sure. Big shout out to the founders, Trina Scott, Bianca Loriano, and Marietta Gary Smith, who are not here. It was at a conference, right? They came to a conference and they saw, in Ida's perfect terminology, a sea of white people. And they were like, what the hell? Because that's not their experience. So it's like, where can we find support? How can we make this happen? So they said, oh, we'll take the responsibility on ourselves and started Waxion. And now we have a couple of hundred folks that are in our Facebook group. And how many are in this directory now?
We have about, this is Ida, we have about 60 people in our directory. We have about 500 people in the Facebook group. And in terms of registered people who we know sort of everything that they do, where they are, we have about 300 people. And part of why you've come to prominence in the past few years, right? Now everyone knows about you. Because you've been doing the work. You've been doing the work. We know that. But everyone kind of knows about you because you became really vocal around this particular situation that I thought we might recap for people.
So basically what happened is that there is the book that shall not be named.
No, it's fine.
We can name it. Secrets of the Sex Masters. So this book came out and a few of us saw the back cover. And for a book that's titled Secrets of the Sex Masters, one would expect that there is a diversity of masters. There's a lot of people with knowledge. And when we looked at the back cover of the book, it was all white people. And we had different perspectives on sort of how we felt about it. But for me personally, it felt painful. And not just because it was all white people, but because friends of mine were in that book. And I felt like they didn't see me. They didn't see my community. They didn't see Wakshin. And so I wrote a post that was personal in nature and talking about how the personal is professional and how it feels like to be a woman of color and have colleagues do this work, gain prominence, but not necessarily share the spotlight or, you know, comment on things like, oh, it's all white people in this book. And so once I noticed that, even before writing the post, a few of us were talking about it, Bianca being sort of another one that was very vocally discussing it in our group. And I poked the people who were in it that were my friends, and I poked the editor, Carl Frankel. I was like, hey, just wondering, you know, how was this book thought of? And, you know, is there a reason why there are no people of color? And we got some people that said, well, I didn't know who else was in it. Or, oh, you know, I didn't ask. A lot of sort of passing the buck or just being honest that they didn't think about it. And I initiated discussions with Carl about, you know, what that meant. What could it be like? And long story very short, the initial response was somewhat all right. We started dialoguing and I wrote my post, published it. And once the Women of Color Sexual Health Network put out their official statement, which I was one of the writers for, once we put out the official statement that we actually gave notice to Carl about, we said, we're going to put out an official statement and we're going to use it as an example of the larger problems in the field. So it's not just about you and your book. Really, you're not the point. You're not the problem, but you're a symptom of this larger structural issue. And we're not shy about using the words white supremacy. A lot of people hear it, they recoil, and that's okay that there's that initial feeling of, whoa, white supremacy. But after that, we need to listen to what the actual conversation is. So after that statement came out, that's when it all went downhill. And there were a set of posts from Carl that were saying that we were bullying them, that we were inflammatory, that we were, you know, persecuting him and calling him a white supremacist, which at no point we did. We were saying that this book and the fact that it was all white people was a symptom, was a, showing the world what white supremacy looks like beyond Klansmen, beyond lynchings. It's not just these big murders that still happen, but it's all these little tiny microaggressions, micro cuts that happen in our field. And so after that is when I think a lot of people started paying attention because they not only saw my personal post, Wakshin's response, but also the shadiness that happened in between, where we initially were having a little bit of a conversation where, you know, Carl clearly didn't understand what race had to do with sex. That's a quote. Didn't really know what that had to do with each other, but was kind of open to learning. But when we put it in a larger context and we're public about it, that's when the sort of name calling and bullying conversation came up. And so I think that that is what started a lot of the momentum that we've had recently, which is unfortunate because Wakshin has been in existence for almost a decade at this point. Mm-hmm. And so it takes the visibility of this action to promote other people listening. But, you know, it is what it is. So I think part of the unfortunate nature of that incident was that not only were we getting called bullies, but that there was no transparency about the process. We were initially talking kind of in back channels, and when we were trying to promote a more public discourse about it, that's when it was harder for people to digest, and specifically for the people that wrote the book. You know, if you're gonna make a mistake, we're all gonna make mistakes. That's okay. How you act once you've made that mistake is what dictates how people will see you and trust you or not. Mm-hmm. And so for someone who, you know, tries to put themselves in this place of being a master or an expert, which, you know, you may or may not be, I'm not gonna say anything, but if you're putting yourself in that place, I think transparency is a big factor, and you need to be clear about who you are, what you're doing, and not be scrubbing things from your website shadily. And that's honestly one of the big problems that we had with it. Beyond the fact that it was all white people, it's the reaction that came after of defensiveness and hiding and backtracking once it became a more visible topic to other people. It wasn't just a private conversation. You know, other people knew what had happened.
I mean, this has a much bigger context, just like you said, which is that this was simply a kind of example, like a real clear example that maybe lots of people could see. They could literally see, like, sex masters positioning these people as the experts, all white, right? It was just an example, which I felt like you made clear. But then there's this personal component to it, right? And I feel like people's first reactions are often defensive. But I'm interested in if you see a link between you being accused of bullying and some of the rhetoric around the Black Lives Matter movement where, you know, where, like, for example, when Bernie Sanders was shouted down and people said, like, they're not being fair, they're silencing him. This notion that we're okay with your activism, but you're being too much with it.
It's gone too far.
Like, do you
you're not
feel
being
like,
polite?
Yeah. You're not respectability.
It's the respect. Yes, the mm-hmm. respectability politics of it. It's like we're okay with this much, but now you're doing too much, and it's making us feel, or you're perpetuating a stereotype, or you're looking at us and it's like, oh, it's too aggressive for me. Like, I can't take it anymore. I can't retain the information or try to be there with an open mind because that's too much. Instead of looking at it from, there's a reason why I got to that point. Like, there's so much, it's a pressure cooker, and now, you know, the top wants to pop off. And I think people have been taking it as well as they're supposed to. Like, but people are uncomfortable. It's like, oh, that's too much. Or they like when you're polite. So they're like, oh, you do it so well if you're not angry about it. But there's lots of reasons to be angry. Like, it's been almost a decade for WakShin, let's say, when they went to that conference and they looked at those folks. But if you go to conferences, that's not uncommon. It's maybe 13 people. And there's different reasons for that. But and to hear people say, how does race have to do with sexuality? Or there are no pioneers in sexology that are people of color. And I'm like, a lot of the pioneers that we put in these textbooks rest on the shoulders of a lot of the people of color, whether it's because you used our bodies or when we look at academia versus like community health educators. So there's layers of it. And it's very, there's a relationship when it comes to the Black Lives Matter movement and the things that are happening within our tiny field. Yeah.
And so let's talk about like the reality of where we are today. What do you think about the diversity at CatalystCon? What is your take as people of color?
I'm glad that there's more than there has been in the past, but there's a lot of work to be done. And the first thing I think of is the fact that our founders couldn't be here.
Yes.
And for some, it's a work issue. You couldn't get time off work or something like that. But for some, it's a financial issue. You literally do not have enough money to go to this conference where your organization has become doubly award-winning, you know? And that's one of the things that when we were tweeting about the award that we got at CatalystCon, Bianca mentioned. She was like, our organization that was founded by these three women has gotten two awards at this point, probably going to get more, you know, knock on wood. And I still have not been able to receive any of those in my hands. Mm-hmm. I still haven't been able to touch this award. And at CatalystCon, I'm glad that there have been steps to include more people of color. And I think, again, the work that WakShin has done and the work that people have started listening to is a big part of it. When we got that award, Dee mentioned like why this started to be like a little thing in her brain, because at a previous Catalyst, or honestly, I think it was at a Momentum, back when it was Momentum, I tweeted, and I live tweet a lot of my conferences that I go to, and I was like, it's a lot of white people. And that initially she was really uncomfortable. She was upset at the fact that I'd mentioned that just by virtue of pointing out a demographic, and that stuck with her. And after seeing, you know, all these things that have been popping up personally and impersonally, I think that that's, you know, catalyzed this fire under people's butts to get it moving. And to what Cindy was saying earlier, this respectability politics thing, if you are only being an activist or only listening to people of color when you're comfortable, you're not doing enough. If you're only listening to people and their messages when they're being nice and friendly to you, you're not listening enough. And we're not saying don't feel bad if you get called out, because that sucks. It's shameful sometimes to feel like you did something wrong, but you need to move past that and see that it is not about you as an individual. It's about you as a representative of a system. And if you're not listening to that layer, and if you're not willing to move past your own defense, then you're not doing enough. And you have to take care of yourself. Because it's, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of, well, if you don't know the pioneers, yeah, we don't get taught those pioneers. Like, we as people of color don't get taught those names. We have to dig through to find that. So we don't fault white people, and we don't fault, you know, people at Catalyst or other conferences for not knowing. We fault them for not digging and not finding that once we tell them it's a problem.
I would love for Ida or Cindy to go into the calling in versus calling out, because they both explained that really well, that the calling out of that book, what it did for the people who were true allies, it made them think of, oh, this is what they wrote. These are the actions that I can take from now on. Next time I'm putting together a book, next time I'm being asked to be part of a book, I need to ask, who are you including? Who else is there? Who is speaking at your place? Who is doing this? And I've seen it happen as other conferences are getting put together and people who are allies are stepping up to ask, you know, do you have somebody speaking on disability? Do you have somebody speaking about trans? Do you have somebody speaking about porn and sex work? And do you have people of color? So it wasn't just only women of color's voices that were elevated. It was other marginalized communities who have been elevated by that one calling out that happened. And it might have made people feel uncomfortable, but the people that really wanted to help, they've stepped up. And even at the keynote here at Catalyst, there was a moment with you and Jenny Block that was absolutely beautiful, and it was a teaching moment, and everybody in the room witnessed how that moment becomes teachable, and how do you do it well?
Okay, we're going to talk about the moment at CatalystCon, and we'll get into more of this, more with Cindy, Ida, and Anaïn when we come back.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education Series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. We are here at CatalystCon West, and I'm talking with several members of the Women of Color Sexual Health Network, Cindy Lee Alves, Ida Mandule, Anaïn Bjorkqvist. And before the break, you were talking about something that happened at the opening plenary. So let's just recap what that was. Who wants to go?
Me?
Yeah, and say your name again so people know your voice.
Anaïn. I don't remember what the question that was asked or what you guys were talking about, but you were talking about being more inclusive.
No, you know what it was? Is she was talking about an experience we had where the first time we did an event together, it became clear that she kind of lived in it. We lived in like two totally different worlds, right? And she was like, so I felt like I was coming from this place of being like suburban and in this open marriage and in a different part of the country. And you were coming at it from like queer, kinky, you know, we told
porn.
Yeah. I mean, we told these stories and she just retold it at lunch, which was we were telling each other about like Thanksgiving and if our parents like got, you know, got us or not. And she was like, My parents said, so you're the parents of your husband and the parents of your girlfriend will both be at Thanksgiving. And she was like, that's correct. And I think Thanksgiving is this kind of, you know, it's obviously a horrible holiday, but it's
so many reasons.
But it's like this metaphor where people have these like big talks or these weird revelations. And so, and at Thanksgiving for me, my mom says, will everyone be sitting at the table? Or will anyone be taking their meal on the floor? meaning like, you know, human puppies who like to have at a bowl or people who, you know, don't sit on furniture or whatever, you know. So that was like, she was like, okay, we are not from the same world. Okay. So she started talking about it and she said, I felt like in that moment, every perspective was represented.
Yeah. She was like, we were so diverse. And you came out and you're like, ah, but we're both white. We were both white. And sort of mentioning that even sometimes when people of many marginalized identities, you know, have those and then they think that they've represented everyone, there's often the missing piece of, you know, racism and who are the people of color. And honestly, the other one that I think gets left out a lot is disability. There's always like, oh, we're so diverse. I'm like, but is it accessible? Mm-hmm. You know, who is disabled in the room? Is there no one in the room? And, you know, with that comment, and I'm so glad you brought that up. What's tricky about that, too, is that we heard a lot of people very excited about the fact that that got brought up. And the excitement was coming from different places, depending on who you talk to. For me, the excitement was that it happened publicly and between colleagues and friends and that everyone saw it. For other people, the excitement was that it was nice and that no one got upset.
I mean, the thing about Jenny was there was zero defensiveness.
Yeah. She handled it very, very well.
I mean, zero defensiveness. And I feel like that made the interaction. It made me feel like, okay, I'm not attacking you. Okay, you know that, right?
But Ida says this, she said it in our workshop, intent versus impact.
Yeah. And if you're, even if you're not intending to do something, if the impact is that someone feels hurt, again, you know, I love metaphors. We've been talking about my metaphor obsession
all weekend.
Metaphor magician, metaphor machine. You know, in this, let's imagine the scenario where you are walking and you accidentally step on someone's toe. If you step on that person's toe, even if you did not mean it, you hurt their toe. Their toe is in pain and you're supposed to apologize and acknowledge the fact that you hurt their toe. And if we translate that into discussions about race, people want to say, well, I hurt your toe, but I didn't mean it, so I don't have to do anything. And when you look at people of color in this like very odd metaphor, their toes are getting stepped on all the time. Maybe you don't even have like, your toes are so squishy at this point because everyone's been stepping on them all the time and no one wants to apologize and no one wants to change what they're doing so that you don't keep feeling that pain. And again, intent is important between friends and between colleagues that know each other because you want to know if you can trust your colleagues and your friends. But if it's a random person, I actually don't care if you meant it or not. I care that what you do after is valid and valuable. And are you listening to what I'm saying that you hurt me? And a lot of people don't. And a lot of people, like you said, get defensive and are just so caught up in their guilt or in their, I didn't mean it. Please forgive me. Making the forgiveness about themselves too. We talked about that in our pre-con that asking for forgiveness is important and, you know, can help build and mend bridges. But if you're asking for forgiveness just to feel good and feel like you're absolved, that's the wrong reason to ask for forgiveness and try to make amends. You should be doing it for the other person that you've hurt, not for yourself.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about your pre-con. The three of you facilitated advancing racial justice in sex education. I was very well attended, but maybe not enough white people, which is like such a weird thing to say, right? Like, there's always enough white people. But no, I was struck when I came into the room that there was predominantly people of color.
Yes. I feel like it was a mix, but it was
but
a
there was a white
amount.
People, yeah. And it was really well attended. It's happening before the conference happens. What are some of the things that came up in the room? What were some of the messages? What was some of the feedback? Cindy?
Well, to me, in my experience of the pre-con, having a mix is not uncommon, which is interesting because it gives a good dialogue because people expect, and not to say that there's no reason to have split, women or people of color-centered things and white-centered things when it comes to this. That's important, too. But to have these conversations in mixed, to get that discomfort if there's discomfort, to be able to air out frustrations and try to listen to people in as safe as a space as we try to make it. But understand that safe doesn't mean comfortable, right? So I think the biggest thing for me in my experience of doing this workshop is the lack of the lack of being cognizant of how much race has to do with this field and sex and sexuality, especially when we look at it historically. So like in doing the timeline and having no idea that some people didn't even have an idea of Tuskegee, and Tuskegee was pretty common in terms of like media representation of it. And
do you want to tell people what Tuskegee is in case they're listening and don't know?
Well, the Tuskegee syphilis experiment was basically penicillin had come out. It worked. But they had a study on black men and we're like, we're not going to give them this to cure the syphilis. We want to see what happens to the body. So we're going to let them live without any knowledge of the fact that this penicillin has come out. We want to see and watch them deteriorate and watch them die for the purpose of science. And
non-consensually.
That's the big piece, right? And it's so many feelings when I talk about that because in my experience as a person of color, I didn't know about that until my graduate work. And you have all these years of schooling of history and social studies being such an intricate and very important piece of work. I didn't know about any of this. So it's a lot of feelings comes out. It's like, that is the people that we've been taught to trust, like medical and school and education. And we're like, we can't trust y'all either. Like it's a lot of mixed feelings. So going back to like the presentation, I think a lot of that comes from our participants. Like, oh crap, there's so many things that have went on that I had no idea about. And a lot of them were also saying like, I was alive back then. Like, what was I doing back then? And whatever age we were, like I had no frame of reference. So I had no idea these things were going on and how they were feeling about it. And I think a big piece of our workshops is, yeah, we're going to give you this information. We want to give you tools. We always want to give you time to process this stuff and process what it is to be in this group and to feel those feelings. And let's talk about it and discuss what it is to know this history now and to say you are part of this field. And this field is amazing. Like, I've been a sexuality baby from the time I went to undergrad. But to deal with, like, the not okay things and what do we do with this not okay past from now on in terms of the work that we do.
And did anything come up that surprised you in the room? They're shaking their heads.
I'm like, no.
We're like, we've seen it all before.
Yeah. I think the one example that stuck out because we actually, you know, on the spot, Ida and Cindy decided, you know, we're going to take out this one thing we were going to do because there's been a lot of media around that exercise. Why don't we just keep going with the conversation? And the question that was asked was something like around asking people about their race or their ethnicity and what's wrong with curiosity. And it was that kind of led us down the rabbit hole. And the conversations that happened in the room were, it was powerful to hear, you know, the white people in the room asking what's wrong with this when I do this. And then to hear people who are mixed step up and say, well, this is what happens to me. And for me as being, you know, the newest member here, it was very interesting to just sit back and watch the body language on people as they're having their shame reaction and the body language that they're hearing, that they're responding with as they're hearing people telling them how they want to be heard. Because I think for me, and I keep saying, you know, Ida, Cindy, the founders, they're the intellectuals, they're the academics. And for me, as someone who didn't always know the stuff until, you know, I became involved, more involved in this group, it was stuff that we think, as people of color, we think it's in our heads. We think that this is just in our head. It's a chip on your shoulder. And you know, I didn't have the voice, you know, the audacity to do the calling out like what Ida did. And when someone like her steps up and the founders step up, it gives a lot of us room to step up and to say, this is how I want to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I deserve.
So let's get back to the calling out, calling in, which we brought up in the last segment. Who wants to do that?
I'm shaking my head with a wiggle because that's my favorite topic.
Yes.
All weekend.
I was like, that's Ida. That's Ida. We know.
Do a little dance.
Okay.
Calling out versus calling in. I have a lot of feelings about it. Calling out and calling in are two strategies that should be part of everyone's toolkit, and we should not throw out one in favor of the other. I've heard a lot of people saying, oh, we should call in, not call out. That's kinder. That's better. It's more personal. And that's true. It is kinder. It is more personal. It is all of those things. But that doesn't always work. And when I hear people, especially, again, white educators, white professionals saying, you have to call out, or you can't call out, you have to call in. First of all, they're dictating how an oppressed people speaks about their oppression, which should not be happening. Second of all, they're going back into that, I'll only listen if you're polite. I'll only listen if you're nice. And your message has no value to me unless you're nice. And they're going into this dichotomy of, you know, you can only do one or the other. And that's not reality. No activism, no movement has only one strategy. Looking at the civil rights movement, we had Malcolm and we had MLK. In every movement, we have the very radical people that are angry and are very vocal and radical. And we have the people that are maybe more respectable and palatable to the audiences that they're trying to talk to. And we need to have both places because, you know, at the very least, the fact that we have those extremes will move the goalpost closer to where we want it. And honestly, that's a tactic. That's also a tactic of the conservative movement. Like, they will have the Looney Tunes that are, you know, we have Donald Trump. Like, we have Donald Trump making very conservative people sound reasonable when they're calling to defund Planned Parenthood, when they're calling to, you know, hurt the rights of a lot of different groups and genders and sexualities and calling for deportations. They sound reasonable by comparison. Mm-hmm. So taking that into this, we need not to say that people who are radical are unreasonable, but some people will read them as such. And it feels bad to a lot of us at WalkShin that some of our founders are not listened to because they're more radical, or because they're seen as angry, and that they listen to people that are more palatable or respectable or even lighter skinned, if not all three. And we need all of those strategies, and we can't just have one. And again, going back to, if you're only listening when it's comfortable, you're not listening enough. And what we're asking white people to do is to get uncomfortable. And we are asking for people to lose some of their power. But in losing some of that power initially, ultimately, we are looking at a world that is more just, where there is more power and more equitable distribution for everyone. So even while you're losing a little piece at first, it will come back to you sort of tenfold in the end, but you just don't see that immediately. So this whole calling in, calling out business, we need both. We need both, and we can't just say call in all the time.
And that radical piece about some of the founders being more radical, for me, when I see someone taking a very strong stand, not just for themselves, for everyone, they take that strong stand and they're being radical, they're taking a very big chance with the opportunities that they are going to be given, because people are going to be afraid to associate with that radical person, but they are very, very much needed, because it was that piece, that the language of it, people didn't like the white supremacy in certain terms in there, and they were shocked. But that was very much needed. And when you put your name next to something like that, you could lose jobs. You could lose opportunities. So I think it's very important for me to say that I felt very called by, you know, that radical side, to know that these people who put together WalkShin were putting themselves on the line. And I could associate with that.
You had this exercise in the Advancing Racial Justice class, mm-hmm. where you asked people to make a commitment in writing with their name attached to it and their contact info for three things that they would do. Is the language like to advance racial justice in sex ed? Mm-hmm. Okay, so three things, you know, you're going to do in the next year to advance racial justice. What kinds of things were on those cards?
There were some that were, you know, what's interesting is that some people, even though we explained it and gave examples, did not actually follow through with the exercise as we had requested. We said, be very concrete, be specific to your field. Don't just say, I'll learn more about racial justice. And some people still did that. And the reason I say that and the reason I think that happens is because this kind of request for commitment is very uncommon. Mm-hmm. Like there is not a lot, there are not a lot of organizations saying, I want you to give me three concrete steps and I want you to give them to me now. But some of the things that people did write is, you know, I will read X amount of books by, you know, an author that we mentioned, or I'm going to Google this term and this particular thing, or I'm, you know, I have a podcast. I'm going to make sure that this percentage of my speakers are people of color, or I'm going to be hosting an event or a conference, and I'm going to make sure that every panel has one person of color on it at the very least. So making very concrete commitments. And the reason we ask for people's info is because we're going to follow up with them. You know, they're telling us their commitments and we want to encourage and support them in following through. We don't want to say, oh, have you done this thing? We want to email and say, hey, you mentioned this. How can we support you? Are you having difficulties? How can we best uplift your commitment so that we all benefit from it, so that you benefit, but the people that you want to include benefit from it as well? And I don't know if folks saw other cards or things like that too.
In my experience of it, we want to remind them that it's a process. We want to remind them that like the fact that you're coming to these workshops is a step and it's amazing, right? But we need you to be cognizant that we need a little more, right? Dee gave us an hour at Catalyst East. Awesome. We saw that an hour wasn't enough. Dee was like, can you come back? Can you do a 4-hour? I wish a 4-hour was enough. We'd be millionaires. Like, learn, be racially just in 4 hours, right? So we know it's a process. So let's talk about action steps. That's part of our workshop. Then think of some that you can do yourself. A lot of times, what's impressive is that people go straight to their own power and privilege. They're like, I am supervisory staff at this agency. I'm going to be more aware and intentional about the hiring process and looking at my staff and seeing like, oh, you know, I'm an organization that works for these marginalized populations. However, the makeup of my staff doesn't reflect that. Why is that? And how is that going to be seen by the people we're supposed to be serving? So it's like, I'm going to work on that, or I'm going to try to implement this training or get people, get organizations that do this work to come train our staff. And again, we get really super energized at these conferences and we're like, yes. But I know a lot of the things that I promise that I'll do at workshops that I go to, I'm like, oh, I forgot all about that as soon as I get home, right? And I'm back into life mm-hmm. and doing the other thing. So that's why we're not doing it like, oh, I'm going to call you out. You said you were going to do these things and you haven't. It's, again, what can we do to support you? I want to hear, like, maybe you did things that you wrote things on those cards that aren't the most realistic and you didn't realize that. And it's like, all right, let's try baby steps. Let's break that down. And let's say, what are things that you can do? Or let's talk about it. And to know that even though you came to this workshop, that we want to support you in knowing that we know that this work is longer than this workshop, longer than this card, and we're here to provide some type of input if we can, if you want to do it. Like, it's a reminder. And I know some people have taken, have done this, and then, like, we used to mail them out and, like, receive their card, and they're like, wow, yes, this is a reminder. And, yeah, I have been doing this work, but this is a reminder, like, so many months have passed, and it still needs to get done, and they felt empowered by it. And I saw like some people were like posting it on Instagram, like their card. And I'm like, yay. So it's, again, it's a work in progress for all of us, not just, you know, the participants at our workshops.
And that's also why it's good that it was a multiracial space, because as we've been talking in our groups and our trainings, people of color aren't anti-racist out of the womb.
Right.
Not every member of WalkShin is actually even anti-racist. Right. So we need to educate ourselves on this too and hold each other accountable. And I think the value in that activity isn't just that it connects us. It makes us human to these people that are coming in. It gives them actionable steps. It allows for follow through, relationship building, storytelling. And it allows us to give examples to people that weren't here about what mm-hmm. they can do. And it also allows us to, in building that rapport, hear back what did they do and have us able to share those good stories of, yes, look at how, you know, how diverse this new conference is, or look at this podcast, how much they've changed. Because, you know, we don't expect perfection. We don't expect people to be amazing right off the bat. But if you can show that growth and show that interest in improving, I feel like that motivates a lot of people. And that's what Anayin was talking about. If you see other people doing it, they see that it can be possible for them too. Like the fact that you know, Dee brought us for this at Catalyst. I hope other conference makers see that and invite us to speak at their conference and see that it's not just one little organization. It's something that you have to do to stay relevant and improve the field as a whole. It's not just to elevate people of color. It's to elevate all people that need that uplifting because they're not getting it at the moment.
Yeah, or Tristan reaching out to Wakshen and saying, how do we, you know, share our audiences?
Our things were scheduled in the exact same time slot just for people. I was teaching a pre-con, which was a boot camp. They were teaching a pre-con, and they were scheduled up against each other. So people would have to choose between the two of them.
Yeah, and sharing that audience. And your audience reacted really well to it. They really liked, you know, the suggestions that we gave. And it was awesome because then you got to give our audience tips on how this matters to making money in the field of sexuality.
Okay, we're going to take another break. We're having fewer commercials this session, which is because we have a lot to say. And we have to take fewer breaks. So that's it. But I know you like fewer commercials, people, so it's fine. Okay, more with this conversation when we come back.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning expert guide sex education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. We are on the Sunday of Catalyst Con West at the moment before the closing keynote. If you want to find out more about Catalyst Con West, go to catalystcon.com. If you want to find more out about my guests, we're going to save a whole minute at the end to do lots of plugging of all your websites and all your media. So I'm talking today with Cindy Lee Alves, with Ida Mandalay, and Anaïn Bjorkqvist. So I feel like this question isn't even fully formed, but I want to know specifically about the work you're doing in sex education and what you see as some of the greatest needs of people of color in sex education. And is there a way in which white sex educators are not addressing cultural difference that we could be?
One is that a common misconception is that Wakshen only does sex ed. We have members who are doulas. We have members who are OBGYNs. We have members who are academics. We have community health educators. We have, you know, a variety of people. And in some spaces, we only talk about the sex ed, but really we want to look at this in the whole field of sexuality, the whole field of reproductive health, of therapy, of social work, all of that. So step one is all of this is related and all of it should be integrated. Step two, or sort of bullet point two, is that we have this idea in the United States of being post-racial being a good thing, and that the more that we can be similar to each other and the more that we can erase differences, the better we'll be. That similar rhetoric is used to talk about mixed babies and mixed race babies, like, oh, we're all going to be mixed eventually, so all of racism will disappear. And that rhetoric is flawed for a lot of reasons, and I can probably speak to that as a mom too. But the idea is that we should not be erasing our differences. We should be celebrating them. And the problem with racism and white supremacy is that systems use those differences to discriminate against people, and that those differences dictate, do you get a job or not? Do you get pulled off the side of the road or not? Do you get killed or not? So we're not asking, and we do not want differences to be erased. We have friends who say, you know, I don't see color. I don't see you as black. I don't see you as Latina. And I'm like, actually, no, I want you to see me as Latina because that is who I am. That is part of my identity and it's important. And beyond it being important and making me feel invisible when you say that, just because you don't see it, supposedly, doesn't mean other people don't. Doesn't mean that cop won't see it. Doesn't mean that the job interviewer won't see Jose versus Joe on an application and throw one out in the trash bin. So this idea of being post-racial is negative and harmful. And a lot of people think it's the right way to go. And we're here to say it's not. That you need to look at the differences and work through, with, and around them, not against them in the ways that we've been taught to.
We exist. Like, that's the only thing that keeps coming in my head. Like, we are more than just participants in your studies, looking at quote unquote health disparities and quote unquote at risk communities. We're more than the reason why you get health funding. We're more than a little piece of an excerpt on the outside of a chapter in a textbook. We're more than just a piece of a chapter on a textbook. Like, that's why intersectionality, I feel it's so amazing and so rich, because you should be talking about race and sexual orientation or gender identity in every single chapter of a sexuality textbook. And in my experience, you open a textbook, you don't see that. And then if you don't see that, don't say, well, none of the textbooks are really culturally competent. No, it's you put in the work to be this educator or this academic and teach these classes or do these coaching, put in that extra work for the betterment of the people you are serving. So if that means you have to look and do research like you did in all your other work to look and say, all right, this chapter doesn't have that, but let me find something that's applicable and make that part of their readings instead of just say, here's the textbook, read the textbook. Or I'm going to make lessons that are intersectional and talk about various things instead of just making it, oh, that's just a lesson, just a day in the lesson.
But don't you think with, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't you think though with sex, there is this sort of, it's sex. We all have sex in the same way. We all have basically the same body parts. And so how, you know, how do we bring this into the field of sex? We're all just, it's all sex. I want to play devil's advocate.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's all sex. So what does race have to do with it?
It's funny that you use the phrase devil's advocate, because usually I'm like, the devil has enough advocates and they all look like you. We don't need any more. But,
no,
okay, but I appreciate it. It's okay. A very important question. So I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Cause we're in a safe podcasting space here. That is actually what I heard back from Frankel when I talked about the secrets of the sex masters. What does race have to do with it? Like, we all want pleasure. It's orgasms. Like, what's the difference? And the first thing to me is you usually need a body to experience pleasure of some sort. Mm-hmm. And the ways that our bodies exist in space and in society are categorically different. So the things that we will be worried about or thinking about when we go and have sex with someone or with ourselves are going to be different. The products that are available to us to express our sexuality are different. You know, when you're looking for dildos or packers or things like that, whether it's for sex or for like gender affirmation, what colors do they come in? And if they do come in a variety of colors, is the black one called like chocolate? Or is the black one called like Mandingo or big black, you know? So there's chocolate. We have work to do.
No, I'm shaking my head. Yes, because it is called chocolate.
It is called chocolate.
Exactly. And you know, sometimes chocolate is fine. Sometimes, you know, calling something chocolate is fine, but it's about the disparity. And, you know, why is flesh tone called flesh tone and it's beige and flesh tone is never brown? In terms of what accessories we have available, when we're looking at porn, what does porn say about our bodies? Exactly. You don't have a white girl category. I mean, maybe some websites do, but usually it's the other. Usually it's the other.
Ebony
and Latina and Asian. And there's this idea. Exactly. There's this idea that white people are the norm and that the category of whiteness doesn't exist.
Doesn't need marking.
Exactly.
Doesn't need naming.
It's the default.
It's the default.
And so, you know, when you're thinking about not just what products you have access to, what erotic media you have access to, what do people in their erotica writing
write about? How do they describe the bodies? If they're unmarked, they're usually understood as white, even by people of color, because we're trained that way. We know that if you're not saying, it's probably a white person, it's probably a white body. And taking it back to a more political level, the idea of reproductive justice and, you know, who has access to different kinds of contraception, the fact that a lot of medical providers peddle long-acting reversible contraception to teens of color without telling them what else is out there because they're afraid that they're going to get pregnant. Like, this is not just about orgasms or sex, but it includes all of these things, and these are all wrapped up together. So when someone says, what does it have to do with sex? Everything. Everything. If we're talking about childbirth or having, you know, families and the rights to have families that you want, and queer folks, you know, some of us here are queer, working to build the families that we want. If you feel like you are afraid to have children because you fear that your children will be killed before they hit 18, that is a sexuality issue. That is not just a racial issue. That's at that intersection. Mm-hmm. And if we don't look at what are the gaps? What are sex educators not talking about? They're not talking about police brutality in their sexuality lesson plans. They're not talking about forced sterilization in their lesson plans. They're forgetting the experiences that are unique to people of color or unique to other communities. Like, if we look at forced sterilization, people with disabilities, there's a huge history of forced sterilization.
And that brings me to the point that I was going to bring up, because Bethany Stevens yesterday in their workshop, she said this thing that she said, stop thinking about what bodies are supposed to look like and how they're supposed to act. And that's something that the people want to get to, like, everybody's going to look the same and everybody's going to act the same. No, they're not. Let's not have a picture in our heads of, like, what things are supposed to be like, and appreciate the differences and appreciate that people need to be able to have access to those resources so they can have pleasure. Because everybody talks about, everybody wants pleasure, but what's their access to have that training that they need for their specific body?
I love what Cindy Lee said. You have to do the research like you did it for your other work. If you write a book, that book did not come out of your butt. That book came out of research.
It might have been about putting stuff out of your butt.
It may have been research about butts, which is amazing. We, you know, butts, butts, butts. So, you know, you have to do some work to get there. You have to, in any field, to be at the top or to be really good and well-known, you got to do work. Same thing goes for this. It's just a lot of people don't want to put the work in. So we need to put that work in as a community, and you need to, if you know that you don't have an experience, go find the people that do, read their material. Don't force them to educate you, but pay them to come talk to your staff. Mm-hmm. Ask them to come to your conference. Give them a platform and the compensation that is required for that platform to happen. Because, you know, what's the other gap? Money.
Money.
Like, we've been talking about this all weekend here at Catalyst with Tristan and with other folks. Money is huge. Huge, and we don't talk about money enough and how to more equitably distribute that money. And that's honestly, that's the biggest gap that I see. Like, beyond the educational content, is that often Wakshin is asked to present for free at everything. Mm-hmm. And the biggest comment that we hear is, well, it's so needed. It's so important. If you don't do it, who will?
Then isn't it?
Then it's more valuable.
It's more valuable.
It's more valuable.
Exactly. It's like there. A lot of people make it sound like it's our fault if they don't have representation. Mm-hmm. They make it sound like it's our fault that there was no training on anti-racism because we didn't do it. I'm like, well, you paid these other people. And why are you not paying us? Mm-hmm. Why do you think that we have to go in for free to teach you something that you should already know, that you should already be researching?
Which is not economic justice.
Exactly.
Which is, I mean, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Saying you have to do the work it also drains you, right? But saying then you have to do it and you have to do it for free is not economic justice.
Exactly.
What we can look at it is money's important, but that also has something to do with how my worth is interpreted. Like, how worthy am I that you won't come out of pocket for this work that you're saying is important, but not enough for compensation? This is work. And not only is it work in terms of putting it together, and, you know, all of us have to do that, but it's emotional work too, because it's stuff that a lot of us have to live through regularly. So it's navigating that. And that's why we also want to do workshops on like self-care too, because it's like you want to do the work, you want to be this activist, but you also have to take care of yourself and know that you are going to get feelings. If you're going to get different conversations that come out, you might get a participant that says, oh, you're being a reverse racist, or I don't know, or like heterophobic, or like I don't know what happens anymore, but how do you deal with those feelings? And then still having to be that person with the power to have to facilitate those conversations and say, oh, your feelings have to be squashed and put in on the side until after the presentation. And that's a lot to navigate, and then navigate it for free.
Exactly. There's always fallout after every presentation. And whether you're talking about sexual assault, whether you're talking about discrimination, whether you're talking about any of these really tough personal topics, there's always the fallout. There's always the stuff that you have to do before, during, and after the presentation. That's emotional labor. That's draining. That impacts, you know, the works that we have to do beyond here. Like, this is not our full-time job. WalkShin is an unfunded, like, organization collective. And we're building and we're doing so much, I think, without a budget. And I just am so excited to think about all the possibilities that can come from this when we have a different level of support. And also think of how unsustainable it is to do this moment, like to have this momentum. We can't have this momentum for 20 years if we're unfunded, because that's what happens too. It's like, oh, well, you look at all you're doing without money. Like, do you really need money? Because you're already doing the work. It's like, ooh,
and you're getting
awards. No, let's not do that. So, you know, to the money piece, you know, calling out folks that are listening, how can you get involved besides talking to us and besides just supporting by listening, thinking about the concrete action steps that you can take? And you don't have to go from 0 to 60. You don't have to go to every rally, go to every march. Like, no, not everyone can do that, and not everyone should do that. And also being very specific about the people of color that you're looking toward, making sure that they have an anti-racist lens, because you know, I personally, and I'm not speaking for WalkShin, I personally don't advocate for any person of color to do a racial justice training, because so many of us still have a lot of growing to do, and we don't know our histories very well. So we can't actually represent these topics and do them justice. So when you're looking for speakers, make sure, if you're asking them to speak specifically on racial justice, make sure that they have an anti-racist lens and that they're not just catering to your white feelings. Because if you're putting a person in a workshop or at a presentation because they parrot back to you everything that you think already, and they're already saying, yeah, no, it's okay that we only have one person. Like, it's fine that we're doing this unpaid. Don't worry about it. You know, you're not racist. It's okay. That's when problems arise, because you think you did the work. You think you fixed it, and you didn't. So looking specifically at the anti-racist lens and how people talk about it is very important to actually being able to do that transformation from going to like from a terrible society to something that's better and more inclusive.
Okay, now is the plugging. Are you ready?
I was like, what kind of plugging?
No, I know what kind of plugging, but okay.
Tune in next podcast.
Cindy Lee Alves, you do guest lecturing.
Yes.
You do workshops for adults and young people.
Yes.
How can people hire you?
I have a Facebook-like page. It's
okay,
Cindy
great.
Lee Alves, sexuality educator and consultant. But if you put my name up, it pops up. I'm also on Twitter, Instagram. It's the Cindy Lee. So T-H-E-E underscore Cindy underscore Lee. I also have my Gmail is my name with periods in between. So Cindy period Lee period Alves at gmail.com.
Anaïn, you are a coach. You teach workshops. You have a podcast. Tell us how we find you in the world.
My name is really hard to say and spell. So you can find me at sexlovejoy.com. That is also the name of the podcast, Sex, Love, Joy. Look for it on iTunes or in SoundCloud. And that's where they can find me. You'll find me by my name, but look for me first on Sex, Love, Joy, and I'll direct you to where you can find me.
Okay. And we're going to post all your Twitters and stuff on our Twitter feed. So, okay, Ida.
I do a lot of things that I'm really upsettingly easy to find online. This is both a blessing and a curse. My website is AIDAMANDULEY.com. On Twitter, I am NeuronBomb, and I'm literally just splayed all over the internet. So if you have my name, you will find everything.
And you do workshops, you do trainings. all of you could be hired to teach advancing racial justice yes. and sex ed.
So many things.
And you're also in school and have jobs.
Exactly, exactly. And like in terms of fields, like we span coaching, sex education. Like right now I'm getting my master's in social work. So therapy, if you live in Boston and you need a free therapist, hey, I'm doing my internship.
Oh, so you're doing your hours.
Holler,
you're
I'm doing hours. So if you need a poly, kinky, friendly therapist, I'm your girl. So just give me a shout out. So we do a lot of different things. And it, you know, if you don't know what you're looking for, but you want to connect, we have the directory and you can always email Wokshn at wokshn.org. Like we have our contact info on our website.
Okay, great. And also you can follow the organization on Twitter at wokshn. Cindy Lee Alves, I Demand a Lay. Anaïn Bjorkqvist, thank you for spending this time with me and doing this unpaid labor.
Thank you.
The next time, we're going to make sure there's a check.
We'll figure it out. Okay? We balance it out.
Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern for another edition of the show. Until then, please, please, please talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.